Hello and welcome to Divan im Gespräch, the video podcast of Der Divan, the Arabic Cultural House here in Berlin. My name is Darius and today I have my co-moderator with me, Merit Jakob-Lakrimdi. And we have a new guest, the Palestinian full-time poet, as he calls himself, Rayath Al-Matoun. Welcome, Rayath.
Welcome.
Born in Damascus in 1979 to a Palestinian father and a Syrian mother, Al-Matoun studied Arabic literature at Damascus University, but I think he was particularly critical of this field of study. Maybe we'll talk more about it later. His poems have been translated into nearly 30 languages, and in 2008 he moved to Sweden. Currently he lives in Berlin and Stockholm. In recent years he has received several awards for his poetry, and in 2022-2023 Al-Matoun curated and edited the German poetry anthology Kontinentaldrift, das arabische Europa, which included 31 Arabic poets living in Germany. And his latest book, I Brought You a Severed Hand, was published this year in English and also German under the title Ich habe dir eine abgetrennte Hand gebracht, this book. Hmm. Yeah, welcome to the show.
Welcome. I want to correct something, that the anthology was for 31 Arabic poets live in Europe.
Okay,
and
okay.
It was that called the Arabic Europe.
Okay, yeah.
It is a series that they did where they published the year before Persian Europe, mm-hmm. and the year before that was Black Europe, and then the Arabic Europe, and I don't know if they will continue with this series.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you for the invitation, and I'm happy to be in the Divan.
We're Great. Also very happy to have you here, and we would like to start by understanding what actually inspired you or what made you want to study Arabic literature as a young person in Syria.
Yeah, I really hate schools and education in general.
I can relate.
Yeah, I never felt that education is a place for me. But I did it anyway. It's the only choice to get knowledge in that age. Later on, I became very anti-academia. I'm still. I have been teaching or giving what I call workshops of my poetry for students who study my poems in many, many universities. But always I began this workshop with the word that, hello, I am anti-academia. I'm not a teacher. You are not student, we are colleagues. Because mostly they are creative writers, mm-hmm. creative students. So many of them already published some books. So the relation for me between two writers is more important than the relation between a teacher and student. So to be a colleague, it means there's no hierarchy. Because in the moment I give something about my way of writing, I gain something about their way of writing, so we learn from each other. So from the beginning, I have this anti-academia thing. In Damascus University, when you study Arabic literature, it's a huge literature, mm-hmm. and you need to choose some part of this huge amount of poets we have. You find that the teacher who teach this mostly are conservative. And in many occasions, I was answering in the exam and I got zero. Like you can't fill five pages of opinion and then you got zero unless you are really damaging something. So yeah, from that moment I understand that there is something wrong, but you can't change it. It is like this all over the planet. To be critical is when you are free, but when you are inside the system, there is no way to become the same way you were before. So I find that even many of the critical minds, after they enter the academia, they were with what we call the, in the box. Mm-hmm. So this is my opinion. I'm not against knowledge. Mm-hmm. Very important to describe this, that I'm really, really a secular mm-hmm. man who believe in mm-hmm. science and knowledge and like this. But I don't like the way the system mm-hmm. we build inside this hierarchy, patriarchy, colonialism history behind it. You know, knowledge is not innocent, as Said say.
Yeah. What? But even like before, like to just step one step back again, before entering university, what made you like interested in literature and poetry in particular?
So it's have two parts. First, it is the problematic part, which is part of the family. So, yeah, because it's really have these two parts. My father is a poet and journalist, and his brother, my uncle Rabi, he's a novelist and also journalist. And my uncle, he won the Arabic Booker Prize for novels. And my father is well-known poet. This from my father's side. From my mother's side, my uncle Salah, her brother, the brother of my mother, also poet, but he didn't publish. By the way, he got killed by Russian and Syrian regime bombing in 2017. And because he's a French citizen, my cousin Omar, his son, he took Bashar al-Assad to a criminal court, but they were not able to take it because he have immunity. But then Assad regime fall down and was accepted. And actually, it was the first case, a private one, as Bashar al-Assad, as a criminal court. It was for my uncle Salah Abu Naboot. And it was the second accepted because there were a case against Bashar al-Assad for throwing chemical attack in Damascus, which is the memory today. Today, the 8th of
April
2012, if I'm not wrong, he was killing 1,400 people with the sarin gas in Damascus. So, yeah, so my uncle Salah is a poet, and my father and my uncle, his brother, are also poets and writers. So from both sides, so I have this kind of background. This is very problematic. It's not something good, and it's not something bad. Let's call it problematic. It's a way helping you. In the same time, it is damaging you totally, because you need your own
ground.
Killing the father, as Freud say, like you need to find your way, especially that this romantic generation, the generation of my father, is the one who caused the biggest damage in the Arabic region, because they were very romantic and they believe in everything but not democracy. they are leftist people. I'm leftist also, but But like, don't forget that Syria, for example, voted twice for a free parliament, and they voted twice for president, elected president, when all Europe was under dictatorship. Greek was under dictatorship, Portugal and Spain was under Franco, most of Europe was under the Nazi and fascism, when the Syrian people voted for free parliament. Actually, after the European liberated from the Nazis. But in that 50s time, so the Syrian people, they don't have democracy. We can't call it democracy, but they were able to have kind of election, and freedom of speech, and separated the powers and like this, until the Hosni Zaim make the first coup with the help, I think, with the American embassy, and ended with Assad dictatorship would lead us to us. So for me, that generation is very problematic, and my father is one of them. They were not criminal, but they were very romantic. And for me, this kind of romance always lead to civil war, is my opinion. Yeah, the other part of how I began to write, it's all began because I want to write a love poem for a girl I really liked.
So romance again.
Maybe it's in that age, 15 years, it should be sentimental. But here we are, after like 30 years, I'm sitting here, totally drawn inside this ocean of poetry. It's all began as a joke or as a need for a young teenager who want to write a love poem. And after 30 years, he's still trying to write love poetry, but no one from the people I know can agree that what I write is love poetry, because it's really the dictionary I use, the memory I reflect, the experience I put in my poems. It's really tough experience. So, and people say for me, like, oh, this is like political poetry. And I say, no, 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 it's not. It's my life. Yeah, but it's political. I say, no, no, no. It's my life. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Every poet in the world reflect his life. I have the right to reflect my life. But my life is a problematic. So the reflection mm-hmm. is like this. What I'm trying to write is love poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe things I'm experience and pass. In the end, I lost two countries. I am Palestinian from Syria. Lost both. Like what? Like I lost both as a country and people. So, yeah. So I always say for them, yes, I write love poetry in the form or in the shape of nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the only way how I describe my writing in one line. But I prefer the second part, the path I choose as a writer, against the path that I got it from my background.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I always feel jealous from the writers who came from a different background,
mm-hmm.
who born without a bookshelf in their houses.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand me?
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. it's always we longing for the things we don't
mm-hmm.
experience.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, I was going to ask about your love poem and how it was your first experience writing poems. And so to summarize you maybe, or if I get it correct, your driver or your inspiration for writing is your life, basically, with which includes love, but also wars, nightmares, and lots of dark things.
Yeah.
So it would be hard to describe it in one word, probably.
Yeah, of course, because literature is... it's a way of dealing with language
mm-hmm.
and saying the things that most of the people say, but in a different way, and especially poetry. Poetry didn't say new things in general, but he re-say the things in a way very... well done, like mm. the language. And in the end, you can't separate literature from the human who write this text. Europe itself, when it was in a critical time, was involved in a text similar to the text many people now in the margins involve in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the center and the margin, they have totally different situation. If I didn't reflect my life, I will be isolated from reality.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the two poems the New Yorker publish every week, sometimes you find good poems there, sometimes. But they are so clean.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by clean, that they are cleaned
mm-hmm.
by someone. And this someone mostly is not the editor, because the writers in the world, they began to do the editing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So they write the text, and if anything political on it, they take it away.
Like self-censorship, kind of.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then they became more professional. They don't write it at all. It came clean.
Mm-hmm.
And you will read a lot of poems, but they will never, never touch the wound. And I don't think this is I don't want to use the word healthy, but this is not a genuine how the texts are.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I accept that what I call my life, it's a political poetry, it's mean that everything in this life is political.
Mm-hmm.
How you could separate an art from the perspective of feminism or the effect of patriarchy or the hierarchy we have of the class in the society? Everything is connected to class and feminism and colonialism history and occupation. Everything around us is related to this political thing we live every day. And then in the end, your text should not be a political, because that is not like people didn't want to read, but it's considered to be a lower in the class of poetry. So I can do that. Anyone could clean his poetry, but I'm not isolated from reality.
And then it's not authentic anymore.
Yeah, for me, it's not authentic. Mm. And people are also, like, this world, I call it, always I call this planet is the planet of hipsters. We have at least 1 billion hipsters in this planet. So one of eight people. And if you put them, all of them, in one country, you got something similar to our life in the Western world. I don't want to say more than this. These hipsters who are able to enjoy their life and have a T-shirt printed on it, the band they like, they have the time to choose the music they want to go and, and having this wonderful life and carrying bag with the name of the expensive supermarket where they buy their stuff. I'm not against that. But this is not the life I want, even if I became rich. It's not about money. You hear a lot about the new rich. You see, nobody like the way new rich behave, yes? But nobody also like the way hipsters behave. There is something missing here. I think literature is a class. And this class, when I say literature, is part of the art scene. You know, in the US, they call us artists. It was a shock for the first time I hear it. In Europe, we are writers. Yeah. But in the US, all of us, even writers, are artists. Anyway, if we take this American way of calling the artist, it's a class. When you are in it, you are outside the hierarchy of the other classes. You can't belong to the middle class or upper class or working class. You are an artist. And you could see this clearly in cities like London, New York, and Berlin, where there is a cosmopolitan, multicultural, diverse background working together. I live in Neukölln. Yeah, I live surrounded by thousands of artists from all over the world. But we live in a bubble. We have this safe zone island. If you went one step outside the ring, you are in Germany.
Yeah.
And that's scary for me. For me, Germany is the most scary place on the planet.
Okay, I think, so we just talked about so many different things. I feel we tackled a lot of topics already that we would both be super interested in to hear more about it. I guess what would be maybe a good idea to start with now is that we hear some of your poetry, some of your artwork. We would love to start with one poem that you will read in Arabic and then I will read in German. And then I guess there are many topics coming up again that we already talked about or that you started talking about right now. It is a poet that is the one that you mentioned already in the introduction of the new collection that was in English published this year, which is called I Have Brought You a Severed Hand. And yes, maybe we start with the Arabic one.
يدي التي خرجت ولم تعد. أنا رجل حر من بلاد ليست حرة. أكتب قصائد حب على هيئة كوابيس وأوزعها مجانا على قتلى ولدوا من أمهات قتيلات. يدي التي ربحتها في السلم خسرتها في الحرب، ولذلك لا أستطيع أن أضمك بشدة. خسرتها في الحرب، ولكنني أحيانا أراها في الحلم تربت على أكتاف الشهداء، فأبكي كالرجال بينما يبتسم الله في الصورة الجماعية، وأحيانا أشعر بالبرد فأبحث عنها لكي أدسها في جيب المعطف، ولكنني لا أجدها. أنا رجل حر من بلاد محتلة، يدي التي أكلها الذئب هي الجزء الوحيد مني الذي لم يلتقي بك، ولهذا نشعر دائما أن هنالك شيء صغيرا ناقصا بيننا. أنا رجل حر من بلاد تحلم بالحرية، يدي التي خرجت ولم تعد، كثيرا ما أحاول أن أضمك دونها، ولهذا أبدو وكأنني أحبك نصف حب، لكنني أريدك أن تتذكري دائما أنني حين أضمك بيد واحدة يا حبيبتي، فإنما أنا أمنحك مزيدا من الحرية حينما يأتي يوم تقررين فيه الرحيل.
Meine Hand, die fortging und nicht zurückkehrte. Ich bin ein freier Mann aus einem unfreien Land. Ich schreibe Liebesgedichte in Form von Albträumen und verteile sie kostenlos an Getötete, die von getöteten Müttern geboren wurden. Meine Hand, die ich im Frieden gewonnen hatte, verlor ich im Krieg, und deshalb kann ich dich nicht fest umarmen. Ich verlor sie im Krieg, aber manchmal sehe ich sie im Traum, wie sie den Gefallenen auf die Schulter klopft. Dann weine ich wie ein Mann, während Gott auf dem Gruppenfoto lacht. Und manchmal ist mir kalt, dann suche ich sie, um sie in die Manteltasche zu stecken, finde sie aber nicht. Ich bin ein freier Mann aus einem besetzten Land. Meine Hand, die der Wolf fraß, ist der einzige Teil von mir, der dich nicht getroffen hat. Deshalb haben wir stets das Gefühl, dass etwas Kleines zwischen uns fehlt. Ich bin ein freier Mann aus einem Land, das von Freiheit träumt. Ich versuche oft, dich ohne meine Hand, die fortging und nicht zurückkehrte, zu umarmen. Und deshalb macht es den Anschein, als würde ich dich nur halb lieben. Aber ich möchte, dass du, meine Liebe, immer daran denkst, dass ich dir, wenn ich dich mit einer Hand umarme, mehr Freiheit gewähre, wenn der Tag kommt, an dem du dich entschließt, fortzugehen.
Yeah, thank you. Could you maybe give us a little bit context about the poem, and especially this very prominent motif of the severed hand?
So when I finished this book, I noticed that there is a man missing his hand. His hand is cut or appearing in many of the poems, and there is a cut hand. It's appear here and there, even in my dreams. And it's in many, many poems of this book. And I'm a very slow writer, so this is a 7 years writing. I publish book every 6-7 years. So I asked two therapist friends, Syrian friends. And the first one, after he read the book, he thought it is my brother who got killed in Syria by Syrian regime in 2016, is the missing hand. The moment I lost my small brother, it looked like I lost part of my body. The other one was more complicated because he say it's right, could be my brother, but also it could be Syria or Palestine. Because in the poem, I will brought you Syria, it's have the same part which I took to be the title of the book, I will brought you a severed hand. So Syrian severed hand, it could be the land, it could be my brother. And because they mentioned my brother, I decided to put it a title of the book, even if it's very problematic in Arabic. and I insist to have it. As a memory for my brother, who last week was his memory, my brother got killed in the 2nd of April 2016, and we didn't find his body. It's like the missing hand. You understand? So we don't have a grave. This is make the things for mothers more difficult. So I call it like this, and I say for the people, my publishers, who I have contract with them, that you have the right to choose a title fit your market. But my Dutch publisher in Holland, he took it the same. And I say for him, Jorgen, you could go for something else, but he keep it. So, and then the English came with the, you see, the British and the American with the same title, even if different cover. The American, they follow the Arabic, which is this, you see.
Yeah, the same.
But they kept the same title. And then I tried with the German. I say for him, like, Hans, you could. And he say, I will keep it. So, yeah, I think they kept the title, even if it's not poetic, very problematic. For me, in the Arabic, I felt that this is should be the title. For other languages, I don't care what will be the title or the cover. I don't interact. For me, that is something, what we call it, bonus. I write in Arabic. I care about the Arabic readers. Or at least I was like this for years. Now it's become more problematic. Before I was only care about the Arabic readers and I say translation is a bonus. But then the translation began to bring big part of the income. And it's opened really windows because like in some countries I have 3 books, like in Holland. In most of the countries I have 2 books. So I began to have readers who contact me. So I don't want to lie about this. Now I am in a situation where I after this 16, 17 years in Europe, paying tax in this continent, I live in the parallel, as we say. So to go back to this, to the title and which lead to this poem, it is about something missing.
Because I asked this question, you because in an earlier poem you also already mentioned, I think, Van Gogh's severed ear.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, he really thinks about severed body parts.
Yes, and I told you, like, in the end, it could be the two country I lost. It could be the brother. You know, like, in many time I was... Like, for example, in 2014, Gaza, where I am from, was under bombing. And Syria, where my family live in Daraa, my mother from Daraa. My mother is Syrian from Daraa. And it is the city where the revolution began in Syria, was under bombing. And I was calling both. It's a very schizophrenic situation. So there is something wrong in the way... the life, I deserve better than this. Like, but in the end, I'm grateful for the life itself because I never felt that I'm a victim. Even if the Palestinians are victims, but in general, they, because we came from very proud culture, and we believe in our struggle, we never play the victimhood card. It's a big difference of being victims. Anyone could be a victim. If there's an earthquake happen and destroyed this country, we will be victims of nature. But to play the victimhood card is something else. I don't want to say I don't respect. There's many people, they have their own way. But it's not me. So for me, I see the things from different angle, from the perspective of the outsider, and I try to judge the things against my own thought, always, as a way of not making justice, but at least be fair a little. So yeah, most of my poetry, I don't exactly know what is it, but I notice that when the years pass, I began to understand a lot of what I mention.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time to my unconscious feelings, put them on the paper, take time until I really understand exactly what they are. I'm quite sure now that the missing in this book, this thing missing the hand or something, it mostly could be my brother, but in the same time, because I lost him in Syria and he is Palestinian, this is like the paradox of it. But it's reflect everything we miss in our lives.
I think it's actually very interesting. You mentioned again very like many things I would love to ask more about. I think like talking about exile maybe in a bit, and also you said it's different perspectives. I think it could also like relate on where you are like geographically, as you traveled quite a lot in your life. But coming back once again to the poem we just heard and the language that you use, you said that now you engage more and more with the European or like Western readership as well. Like before, you were more focused on the Arabic readership. And I feel that, for example, when you said now that the missing hand, it could also stand for everything that we basically miss in our lives. So anyone can relate to this in one way or the other. But in engaging with the European readership, for example, and emails you receive, questions you receive, I imagine that it is like a huge difference of what people make out of your poems here compared to, for example, Syrians who would read your poetry. And that maybe, for example, there are some things that here would be perceived as a metaphor that you actually mean literal.
Yeah, I understand. No, it's a very, very good question, because it's really... You touch something I always try to say about metaphors and that metaphors and reality. But first of all, I want to say something, that Europe is one of the biggest Arabic places on this planet. Germany is the biggest Palestinian community in the world outside Middle East. And yeah.
Thank you for adding this.
Yeah,
very important.
It is really, it is the biggest community in the world outside Middle East. And like, these people who are Arabs who live in Europe, Moroccan or Lebanese, Egyptian or Yemeni, they live here for years. And they will never be accepted. Compared to 5 years expat came from Poland and got after 5 years the German passport, and he's full German. He's really like after 5 years. Nobody will mention that 5 years ago he came from Poland or Latvia. While the Turkish families who came in 1910, and now they have the fifth generation, they call them Turk. Even if they don't speak Turkish, they have never been even visited Turkey. And this is show you more that the Arabs we have in Europe, they are citizens and they pay tax, but they are Arabs. And they will remain Arabs forever until Europe changed and became not racist. So these people are part of the readers. And they are really, really big part of the readers, because they are outside the dictatorship and outside many of the problems that stand between you and reading in the Arabic region. So when you publish a book, your readers in the Arabic country, and you have your readers in Europe, and we speak about millions, I really mean it, millions of readers Libyan or Tunisian or Kuwaiti or Omani who live in Europe, from London to the borders of the Arabic country in Istanbul. So these are huge amount of readers. And you can't deny them. These people pay tax and they live in democracies.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very important voice because people like me, they have similar life like them. So my poems touch them very well. You understand me? So we can't deny that. And this is also part of everything happened. You know, United States of America is by accident didn't speak German.
Mm.
There were even discussion in many states, like if the language should be English or German, you know. The German people forgot that. They forgot that they are one of the biggest refugees and immigrant in the world. And this is a very problematic words. Refugee, immigrant. So if you are from Syria, one of the most well-educated countries in the world, the majority of Syrian Finnish university before the war, and they are more well-educated in Finnish university, more than many country we live in here in Europe. We don't want to mention names. But the Syrian, when they come here, they are immigrant in the best scenario, and they are refugees after the war. But for somebody came, even from war, he's expat, like Ukrainian. So I want to say this double standard make the people feel different about the things. When Hannah Arendt wrote the article, the essay, sorry, the long essay, We Refugees, she tried to describe the situation of Jewish refugees who ran away from Europe, from the Nazis, from SS and Gestapo, and from the whole anti-Semitic situation outside the land of the Nazis. Because as you know, Europe is anti-Semitic. When they ended in New York, mostly in New York, they were feeling shame to say we are refugees. And they changed every sign on the offices and like this to make it immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
And she tried to describe this very well about this people who arrive in a very terrible way, running away from the Nazis, lost their families in the concentration camp and arriving, but they were not able to say, I am a refugee. Mm. They try always to say, I am an immigrant. This is show you how terrible that the situation to make these people don't accept what they are. Mm. They are refugees.
Mm.
You understand me? And if you take this article, We Refugees by Arendt, and you take the word Jewish and put Syrian, it will work well. You don't feel that all these years have come after it, like 80 years.
Mm.
And if you take Syrian, put Palestinian. If you take Palestinian, put Ukrainian. Like, this is the same.
No.
There's something wrong in the way we deal. Our system say this is a refugee and this expat and this is immigrant. But in the end, the immigrants of this planet are the white people. They occupy the planet. 90% of the immigrant and refugees of this planet now, they came from Europe to Australia, South Africa, all America, like the whole world. So when you say immigrant, you mean 9 times white man and 1 time the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
People have fish memory. Yeah, the Europe in some part was empty.
Mm-hmm.
Like Belgium in the First War was empty.
Yeah.
Everyone was refugees. Poland. In Iran, there were 60,000 Polish refugees. In one village in Syria, there were 500 Syrian and 3,500 Polish refugees who later refused to accept even one Syrian refugee. Yeah, people have fish memory.
Yeah.
I'm speaking of Poland in the Second War, not like Belgium in the First War.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you were talking about like nationalities, also identities. When you think about your identity, how important is the nation? Like you mentioned being Syrian, being Palestinian quite often. So how important is that? And isn't there more than just the nationality you have got? Or you don't have it because some people are stateless. So, yeah.
Yeah, I remember I went to the exhibition of Hannah Arendt here in Berlin after the first lockdown, I think, 3 years ago. And I was really happy when I saw that she have a paper written stateless, similar to the paper I have in Syria. I born to a stateless, documentless family. The people in Syria are too kind. The Palestinian are too kind. The people who came after the Nakba, 1948, occupation of the Palestinian land, which I lost Ashkelon, Majdal, our city. So the people who arrive there, they are the majority of the Palestinian Syria, and they have Palestinian Syrian refugee document, like a travel document for refugees. And they are the majority. They are 90% of the Palestinian. In that time, my family went to Gaza. Ashkelon was the only part of Gaza Strip Israel took in 1948. People didn't know that Ashkelon was part of Gaza Strip. So my family, they are from Gaza Strip, and they went refugees in Gaza. My grandfather and grandmother, they built a tent in what became later Khan Yunis refugee camp. In 1967, in 1948, my father was 6 months old. So he's like 6 months older than Israel. In 1967, when Israel occupied Gaza and West Bank, they occupied Sinai from Egypt and Golan Heights from Syria and small part from Jordan. And in that time, Israel grew up from 20,000 square kilometers to 200,000 square kilometers. So Israel in one day became 10 times bigger. Then when they occupied Gaza, my father arrived to Gaza 6 months old, but now he's 18. They arrested him with another 250 people, and they took them in a 4 days journey through Sinai Desert without food, only drops of water. Until they arrived to the Suez Canal, they put them in the boats and throw them on the Egyptian part. But they kept my grandmother in Gaza, which we never see. She died in 2012 alone. At that time, my father ended in Syria. And these people who came to Syria from Gaza and West Bank, we call them the Palestinian of 1967. They don't have any documents like the people in 1948. So all of us, we are stateless towards the world, but we extra have paperless. So we don't have any document. So when I saw that Hannah Arendt, she have this paper that say stateless, documentless, it's remind me of myself. So my situation in Syria was that I don't have ID to say who I am. I'm not allowed to work. And I'm not allowed to own house. I'm not allowed to have drive lessons. And I'm not allowed to travel. And if I travel, I'm not allowed to go back. So we were totally paperless. We are not a big group, maybe 50,000, while the rest of Palestinians are around 700,000. The difference between 1948 and 1967 is simple like this. In 1948, the whole world accepted the new country as Israel. The Soviet Union was the first country accepted Israel, and then the US and Europe and the United Nations, all of them accepted this new land with it was 80% of historical Palestine, became Israel. Because the whole world accepted that, the Arabic government granted the Palestinian refugee a paper to leave because they knew these people will not go back. But when Israel occupied Gaza and West Bank, the Soviet Union, the European countries, the United States of America say this is an occupation of the Palestinian territory. According to the law 242, Palestine is occupied and Israel should move. And the refugees should go back. And because that, the Arabic country decided to not give us any paper because they don't want to give Israel any position or any reason to not let us go. But the time passed. From 1967 until now, we don't have any paper. It's became so crazy situation. So I born to this group. And if you think about it, like, it's man, like, I can't describe it for you what it's mean to be in a dictatorship, security stopping you in the street. Typical question, IDs, everyone give, and you don't have, and you need to explain for them, but you are in the most classic, aggressive, bloody dictatorship on the planet. You ended in security offices until they check a lot of paper. They understand, oh, yeah, this group, we didn't give them a paper. But if you are lucky to stay alive, and this could happen any moment in a country like Syria. So this is the situation I lived in. And it was so difficult to leave Syria without paper. I make a paper. I make Palestinian Authority passport. I pay money. I use the corruption. And I left in 2008.
You actually touched upon a question that I'm thinking of quite a lot at the moment, which is like talking about temporality in exile, basically, or like the how time, what different phases of time there are. And you said that, for example, your father then like arrived in Syria. So you have the arrival and then you have like the state of waiting to get papers to return to, maybe also like adapting, building a life in another place that's actually not your home. And then there's this question of like returning. So is it like a dream that I one day may be able to return to where I actually want to return? And where am I actually returning to? Like now that you were describing that you're basically living in a double exile from Palestine and Syria, the question would be like, what does, like, how do you think of like returning to somewhere, or do you actually feel you belong to a place you would like to return to? Or earlier you said like you're living in a parallel world, so how is this fitting?
Yeah, I always remember things that make me have a balance in my soul. And when I say I remember things, it's mostly I remember people who were passing a similar path. I remember Adorno, he said that a man who lost his country or who lost his homeland, writing becomes his place to live. And I always thought that this is really describe a lot of what I want to say. In the same time, it may give me relief. But in reality, it have something romantic for him, and also if I use it. Because in the end, when he say it, he was like, I think he was in that time, maybe in he went to California. He ran away. But he knew that there were no settlers taking his own country and call it something else, like what happened to me. So the losing of Palestine is something different. Because in the end, we pay our land as a solution for something we didn't do. We pay our land as a deal for what European people did to the Jewish. They were this, what we call anti-Semitic, ended in final solution. And we were weak part. So England was able to make Balfour Declaration 1917. And immediately after that, they occupy Palestine and they let all the Jewish to come, which was not very problematic for the Palestinian if all the Jewish in the planet came to Palestine. Because if you think about it, all of them were Palestinian citizens. Golda Meir was a Palestinian citizen. Ben-Gurion was a Palestinian citizen. Most of the president now in Israel were Palestinian citizens. Many of them, they got the visa from Beirut, from the Palestinian embassy, and came and paid tax, and they granted them. Our problem was not that Jewish refugees are coming. We were welcoming them. we accept every Ashkenazi Jew came from Europe surviving from the Nazis. The problem is they took the land in one day and they push us out and they call it Israel. So we accept them. They didn't accept us. And these blue eyes, white-skinned people who didn't belong to this society suddenly became our, not only like push us our side country, they follow us, bombing us in every refugee camp. Like they bomb every refugee camp in Lebanon, every refugee camp in Syria. And like, it's like, I don't know how to describe it. So if I think about it, I feel that this kind of exile have something wrong in it from the beginning. Because in the end, the world tried to say that Jewish are victims, but they are not. Ashkenazi Jewish are the victims. Let's say the things by their names. The European Jewish were the victims. The European people killed the European Jewish. You could say, yes, the Ashkenazi were the majority of the killing. The Sephardic were killed also. Yes, the Sephardic killed in Greek, in like Spain, but also by European, Fernando and Isabella in Spain, and the European killing. So in the end, the killing of the Jewish majority, 90% of it was of the Ashkenazi. And even when the Sephardic got killed, Mizrahi and Sephardic were killed by the European. So let's face it, there is something called anti-Semitic in Europe, even if they try to call it imported anti-Semitic now in a country like Germany. It's a genuine in this country. It's hate for no reason. It's have a lot of mix of things. And we, as a Palestinian, we pay the solution. So in the end, to be for me born in Syria, from the beginning, I inherited a lot of questions. Berlin, one of them. Because even if England granted the Balfour Declaration, the Jewish were not coming to Palestine. They were running away from the Nazi to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And you could check the numbers of the Jewish who arrived to Palestine from the Israeli organization. You can check them.
Yeah.
And the numbers were right. So even after all this happened, the Jewish didn't come to Palestine. They ran away to other places. What make the creation of Israel needed, it was 3 years after the end of the war, 1948. And it was because of the Holocaust. So the Third Reich played the biggest role of the creation of Israel and the need of the Jewish state. And if the Staatsraison of this country is Israel, it's mean the Staatsraison of this country is Palestine. Because what the German did caused us to have now 17 million refugees and one of the most difficult occupation in the world. And this all happened because of the German Nazi history, which the German, they say Israel and they cut, but they didn't tell what happened because of when the creation of Israel. We have biggest and the oldest occupation in the world now. And the German must not need or should, must deal with this. So if Israel starts to resolve, it's mean the Palestine question is starts to resolve.
Yeah.
Because it's resolved of it. And they need to deal with it. So in this double exile, to be a Palestinian, born in this situation, in the same time I choose my own exile, to run away from the dictatorship of Syria. In this double exile, you could see the things from different angle. No doubt about that. No doubt that the exile is a very problematic place to live, but also is very, very creative place to be in. And the need of the exile in literature is so important to the level some of the writers I met in Europe, they are a little jealous. Yeah, they are really little jealous that they don't have the opportunity to find themselves in this situation outside their safe zone. most important thing is, if you will go back to your question, if where I belong and which nationality, definitely I'm Palestinian, born in Syria. And definitely I will not born without the occupation, because there is no way for my father to be a refugee in Damascus and meet my mother. And I wrote it in one of my poems. But in the same time, what I'm longing for and what I'm fighting for is the right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
I want Palestine to be liberated, and then I will buy an apartment in Berlin. I want to have the right to choose like the rest of the people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go to Palestine, and I say, oh, it's awful in the summer. Everything is sticky. I hate this country. I want to be able to say this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be able to say that, oh, I love the Palestinian food, without somebody say for me, this is not Palestinian, it's Israeli. And then I need to lecture him, like, what do you mean by Israeli? So are the Jewish, they love the Arabs so much, they call all their foods with Arabic names, didn't have meaning in Hebrew, and only have meaning in Arabic? And they call it always names they can't pronounce, so they can't call it a Hebrew name. So they love us, and by accident, all the food. So no one in Israel could say hummus. All of them say hummus. Like, are you joking? Or you understand all these symbols.
Sure. Yeah.
And by the way, they can take all the food. It's okay for me, but give back the land.
Yeah.
Who care about food?
Yes. Yeah, getting closer to the end of this very interesting discussion. My last question would be, like, you live now in Berlin since a few years already, and at one point you chose Berlin, like, as a place to stay and to live, part-time at least. And my question would be, how did your perception change in terms of Berlin being an artist, a writer in Berlin, and now considering, especially in the last 1, 2, 3 years, the silencing going on, like talking about topics you just mentioned, Gaza, Palestine, Syria, civil war, genocide, all of these topics are more and more difficult to talk about. And what's your way of dealing with this, and your perception on Berlin, the city, its people? What do you make of all of this?
Yeah, so when I was thinking about how the Jewish were trying to escape Europe, I was having all the time this romantic idea. I think most of the people have it, that if I was in that time, I will fight back if I was Jewish, and I will try to help if I was European, you know. Mm-hmm. Mostly, you ended with this romantic idea that we fight back. So this is my imagination, and I was having guarantee that this will happen. The first things I think about it after 7th October was to run away from this country. But then I began to say, what you were saying, if the totalitarianism attack, you will fight.
Mm.
So I felt shy from myself. But then I decided, no, I will stay here. And I will try to play my role as a writer and as intellectual, or as Gramsci say, organic intellectual, by not being isolated from reality. By accident, I was the first person canceled in Germany. Later on, we find that there's 6 people were canceled before me, but they didn't announce it in that time. So on the 12th of October, the House for Poesie canceled the release of the anthology I did for them. In the 5th of October, 5th of October 2023, they sent me an email that everything is settled. We invite the guest. you and the moderator and the other editor, you will be on the stage. Everything is settled. The 7th of October, 2 days after that, Hamas committed the 7th of October. The 12th of October, I got an email that they don't have budget and they postponed the event without even mentioning the word postponed. Sorry, they say we canceled. So we find that we have little budget and we canceled. Mm. No sorry, no apologize. And the word postponed was not exist. So when I announced it and it became a scandal for them, and they were attacked from poets from all over the world, especially Jewish poets from New York and London like this, they tried to fix it by making me a liar. They say, oh, we only postponed it and like this. Mm. And then I show their email. I put it on my social media, no. Show that they are liars. They are so coward, and I didn't respect them at all. And I don't know how these people even can write poetry. The poetry in Arabic, poetry came from shu'ur. Sha'r is poetry, and came from shu'ur, from feelings. I don't know how these people even have feelings. To cancel an anthology have nothing to do with Palestine. It's 31 Arabic poets, most of the poems about love. And it's like, I didn't say even anything. It was still the 12th of October. Of course, now we are, if you go to the archive of Silent and you check the list of cancellation, today we have 215 public cancellation. There's somehow the same amount, around 200 cases, where people have been cancelled and they decided, and documented actually, but they decided to not put it public because they are afraid that the rest of Germany will see it and they will be accused of anti-Semitic and they will lose their job. So let's forget these 200 cases. We focus only in the 215 cases which publicly published. It is one of the biggest in the history of Europe. A cancellation happened in a very systematic, organized way to silence, cancel, and erase the voices of the Palestinian people, who in fact say nothing. Like many of them, they didn't even say anything. And this is like, it's so crazy. I publish a long article in The Nation about this in the US. And The Nation, they took it from a speech, a yearly speech in SPOW 25 I did last year in Amsterdam. And it is 4,200 word speech. So The Nation can publish around 3,000. They publish a shorter version. But the original version was published, translated and published in the Groene Amsterdam, the Green Amsterdam in Holland. In this speech, I tried to describe the situation that 22% of the people who have been cancelled in Germany, they are either Jewish or Israeli Jew. So if we consider that this country have 83 million from a Christian background and 200,000 from a Jewish background, you will find that to be a Jewish in Germany, you are cancelled 83,000% more than being a Christian, white German. So officially, Germany not cancelling the Jewish again. It's already continuing cancelling the Jewish. So if you think about this, and if you think about my cancellation, which I always consider to be a very dangerous one, for one reason, that if you think about the cancellation of many people, it is because something they say. They consider it anti-Semitic or threatening of Israel. Oh, I don't know. But I didn't say anything. And my book have nothing to do with Palestine. So why they cancel me? They cancel me because of my identity. And this is why I consider it very dangerous, because this is what happened in the 30s. People were canceling the Jewish because of their identities. And suddenly it's happened again by accident in the same country 8 years ago. In general, I don't trust the gentleman culture. In general, this is before the 7th of October. I never trusted anything German, even the cars, because I can't trust people who killed 6 million Jewish only 8 years ago. For me, done with this culture. And many people told me this is too much. I say, okay, but I don't trust. But after the 7th of October, I don't want to say I was right, But it's so strange for me that the people who silenced their neighbors because they were Jewish, I'm speaking about the 30s, before the killing began, they are, now their grandson tried to silence. Like, you should see the shock of the Israelis to understand the shock of the Palestinian. Berlin have a lot of Israelis. You should really see how they shocked. Like, these people are able to demonstrate in Tel Aviv against Netanyahu, write article in Yadaot Ahronot and Ma'arif and Ha'aretz against what's going on, and they call it by its name, genocide or ethnic cleansing or apartheid. And then they come to Germany, and a white man or white lady, her grandfather was in SS, and her other grandfather was with Gestapo, using this and telling this Jewish Israeli that they are anti-Semite because they criticize Israel. This is enough for me to describe for you the situation. So Germany, for me, took the things to another level, because to counsel people in the 30s, in the time of the black shirts and fascismo, in the time of the Nazi and dictatorship, is predictable. This is what I'm expecting from dictatorship and totalitarianism. This is, for me, it's okay. You say for me, the Nazi, they counseled? Yeah, of course. This is exactly what they're supposed to do. But to have a cancellation of 215 cases in democracy, then it's really not red flag, it's warning. And it's warning from history that because of never again, we are doing really, really many bad things again. In this situation, I think the harvest will be very bad. Yeah.
Thank you so, so much for this conversation, dear Hayat. I have one very short, very last question. Are you an optimist?
Yeah, I was optimistic until 37. And when my brother got killed, I noticed that I didn't become pessimistic. I became realistic. So from that moment, I understand that the opposite of optimistic is realistic. So I'm a very realistic person these days.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.